That's B. That's what that stands for. Been off. I've been off all my life until I get into AA. The end of the Ben House system. Oh, wasn't that a stinking mess? I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and so I had to find AA. But it wasn't always like that. In the beginning, when I drank, oh, I can remember a lot of good times, pictures and clandestine and parties and dances. I had 99.5% fun and about 0.5% headache. And as time went on, I got to where it was 50% fun and 50% headache. Well, that was even Stephen. That wasn't too bad. And about that time, I tried to get back to where I had 99% fun, and I didn't get there. And the ratio kept changing, and it got to where it was 99.5% headaches and 0.5% fun. And I give up on trying to get back to where I had fun. I just drank to get drunk then. And so did you. Yeah, we give up on that idea. Oh, I always visualized those wonderful times, but I couldn't get back there. In fact, when I was 22 years old, I knew that I didn't drink like other people. Time meant nothing to me. Money meant nothing to me. The rest of them would go home, and it was just the drink of the evening to me. Well, I had a relative that owned a drinking emporium in Cleveland, a block away from Wayfarer's Lodge. Wayfarer's Lodge in Cleveland has a floating population of about 2,500 German derelicts. It's supported by Cuyahoga County and the city of Cleveland. And a lot of these boys stopped in at this saloon, and I was asking questions. And they gave me a lot of help. One thing they told me that I'll never forget, if you start drinking in the morning, you're on the skids, but fast. And I had a few drinking mornings the last year of high school. So I had to shut that off. Another thing that they didn't tell me in so many words, but I realized it was there with every one of those men all through their lives. It can't happen to me. But it did. And I knew it could happen to me. I don't believe there's a man on Skid Row any place in this world that ever planned to be there. They all had the same idea. It can't happen to me. But it did. So I knew it could happen to me. Well, I shut the morning drink off. And for 10 years, I didn't take a morning drink. In fact, in 1936, I didn't even have as much as a teaspoonful of beer for 3 weeks. You see, that was the worst thing that ever happened to me, because I always look back on those 3 weeks and I say, I can take it or leave it, can I? Didn't I hold it? 3 weeks without a drink, isn't that wonderful? Well, things got from bad to worse, as you know. They always do. And a lot of things happened to me. Opportunities went out the window. I drank up a business that took 3 generations to build up. Drank a roof off of 4 houses. I was in bad shape. The last winter that I drank, there were 4 cards in the mailbox. One from my mother and father, my sister, my brother, and 1 friend. Isn't that a wonderful record? Things started to happen awful fast to me about spring of 42. I figured that maybe the reason that I got involved and I was so free to get involved was because I was a salesman, and I'd better get myself a job where I would be confined, like in a war plant. I had to have a pass to get outside. I couldn't drink. And I'd be all tired out at night. I wouldn't have to be half-gassed in order to go to sleep. So I got a job at the Aluminum Company of America in Cleveland. There's a plumber's helper. Oh, and I will never work so hard in my life. And I take the paycheck like I always did. I didn't know he was getting cash to the bank. I was taking this room. And one time, I got the paycheck cash, and the bartender took out what I owed for the week. And he says to me, Dunhoff, I hope you never quit drinking. Oh, did that hurt? Here, this guy couldn't even laugh in English, and he went to Florida, and I stayed in Cleveland to play football. No wonder he didn't want me to quit drinking. That's bad, you know. It bothers me. And another thing that turned up, I was inducted in the Army in May of 42. On a Thursday morning, they took me to Camp Perry up at Fort Clinton on Lake Erie. And the next morning, everybody went to chow, and they took me to a hospital in a station wagon. Well, I wasn't feeling so bad. I only polished off another guy and I a gallon of wine on the train from Sweden to Port Clinton, but, well, wine never agreed with me anyhow. So, at noon, they released me from the hospital. I went over to Chow House, the rest of the boys were there, and somebody whispered, "That guy Benhoff's going in secret service." I didn't have a uniform for him. So, the next day, they gave me a bus ticket to go home. And I went to the doctor, and they said, "What's wrong?" He said, "You're an alcoholic." "Oh," I said, "you must be mistaken. I admit to a little heavy drinking last couple of weeks, you know, after all farewell parties and so on." He said, "Well, you got your system put years to get that way. You didn't get out in 2 weeks." "Well, you know, that hurts to call me an alcoholic. That's a very word. I couldn't go back to prison and tell my people that I was thrown out of the Army." "Oh, that is oblivion. I'll go west. I'll change my name. They'll think I died a hero." But the bus was waiting, and it was to take me to Cleveland. So when I got to Cleveland, I explained to my friends and relatives that I was scheduled for officers' training school, that I'd have to wait a couple of weeks. It was filled up. No basic training for Donald right into officers' training school. Well, a couple of weeks went by, and people said, "Well, you're going to that early again." Well, I didn't have a uniform, and then I explained to them very confidentially that I was in secret service. I couldn't tell them I was an alcoholic. Well, you know, living that way wasn't so good. And I had to get half gas all the time, and I got this job, and it wasn't so good. And this one particular night, I'm on the front room floor because I couldn't stay in a chair. And I wasn't stiff from bowling either, I'll tell you that. And somebody was talking to my wife in the kitchen, and this man, he was a collector. You might know nobody else came up to see me. He says, "What's the matter? Is this a gun on steak?" And she says, "No, the damn food's drunk, can't you see that?" Well, I knew of a man and woman walking around clean, happy, and confident. And they belonged to some club where the people in it didn't drink. And this man and woman happened to be a brother and sister of mine. My wife's sister and her husband. So the next morning, instead of going to work, I looked them up. And I got the big book, and I took it home, and my wife said, "James, because I didn't go to work." And I said, "Look, I'm going to get in this club with Art Nedlin." "Ah, with Art Nedlin! Damn good, you guys!" Well, I got in it. I went to see him that night, and you know those guys that I talked to, they made it rough on me. They told me about meetings every night in the week in Cleveland, and 2-3 meetings a week and every night. I said, "Well, let's go." "Oh, no, you can't go. You got to stay home a couple nights this week. Without drink, we're going to send some people over to see if you're an alcoholic." Oh, that word alcoholic popped up again. I didn't give a damn that it called me an alcoholic. I wanted to get straight around. Well, I told them on the idea of sending me to my first meeting. Well, okay. That was the end of the Benhoff system and the beginning of the AA system. Thank God for that opportunity. I went to these AA meetings and I listened to these red-nosed strangers talk about God without hesitation, without reservation. Well, I wouldn't take dollars if Charlie Adler had his face over. That's the way I felt about it. Well, I know these people weren't students of theology, and I couldn't doubt their sincerity, and I knew they were sober, and that's the way I wanted to be, so I kept coming. And what a revelation. I couldn't believe that there were people with such honest intentions, total strangers, going out of their way to help me. And nobody on this wide green earth knew that there was a bigger louse living than me. But you know, like a lot of AAs, I reacted pretty much the same. I liked the sobriety business. I liked the people in it. I was the center of attraction. You know, they were taking me around. I must meet Howard Benhoff. He's a new man. And boy, give me that song of dancing. And all my life I wanted to be the center of attraction. Here I am, saying, but look what I am. And the band's playing, and I love it. Well, 6 months went by, and like a lot of new people, I thought that there could be some changes made. At least the big book could be rewritten. The steps certainly could be changed, and maybe a couple added. And I became critical of the speakers. After all, I was over 6 months. And I began to think, well, why should I go to these AA meetings and listen to some jerk tell me how to get drunk and how to get in trouble? I know how to get drunk. I know how to get in trouble. You see, I was becoming so critical. I was thinking, well, they're spending 99% of their time telling how drunk they got, where they got drunk, and how much money they lost, how many jails they were in, and only 1% of the time telling me an interpretation of the AA program. Well, I've got to get up too early in the morning. I can't stay out all night at these AA meetings and listen to these drunks telling me how I get drunk and I get in trouble. So I stay away. I'll lead a decent Christian life. I'll pray in the morning for help. I'll thank God for sobriety at the end of the day, and I'll be all right. I quit the job of aluminum company, went on the road, and I was doing all right. I was staying sober, period. I wasn't enjoying my sobriety. I didn't have what they call a peace of mind and a sense of well-being. And another thing that I didn't like about this AA deal, now I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew that. I knew I couldn't drink with safety. There was no question about that. But you see, when I came into AA, I was the youngest man in Cleveland, except for one other fellow. He was about 6 months younger than me, and I never met him any meeting I went to. And most of these guys were meant to be my old man. And I figured, well, they're in AA because if they ever drank again, they'd die. I don't think I'd die. I was pretty good shape. You know, all these things add up. And I was even beginning to think, well, my mother's 65 years of age. She can have a cold bottle of beer on a hot summer afternoon. But then, doesn't it always something come up and say, no, you can't, you're an alcoholic. So I didn't have this peace of mind, I didn't have this sense of well-being, and I was sober a year. So I thought, well, I better get back to AA. That's where they tell me about it, that's where they got it, that's where I'll have to get it. But I went back, and I said to myself, you're going to get acquainted with people who have been sober for at least 10 years. Well, there was nobody. I said it for two. I thought, well, anybody that's sober for 2 years, he can't get himself that long. This must be the McCoy. What kind of people are they? Benhoff, it's up to you to get a clue of those people. Well, this is what I found. Men and women who had a sincere desire to do something about their problems, their motives and intentions were always proper and honest. AA to them meant active appreciation. And that is the big difference, as I see it, in AA and anything else I've ever been affiliated with. For instance, You and I know of some people who can go to church every time the doors are open. But by the way they perform, you wouldn't trust in any building you can show this building. And we know of some people who can go to every stated and special meeting of the lodge. But by their performance records, you're reluctant to call them brothers. And we have some in AA that can go to meetings every night in the week and help out to 20 people a year and still get sick. Because in AA, if your intentions and your motives aren't proper and honest, you expose yourself by getting plastered. I believe that because I believe it's by the grace of God we come in here, and it's by the grace of God we stay in here. Early when I came into AA after this first year, this one man that was sober for 2 years, he gave me something that I hope I'll never forget. He said, "Ben Hunt, you found your own private little gutter. You didn't like it there. It was full of heartaches and tears and strife and turmoil, and it stunk. And you reached up and you said, 'God, please get me out of it.' And God reached down and he took you up. But any time that you take that left hand and you go back to pick up some of that dirt, God's going to let go because you and the dirt are going back in the gutter. I believe that. I don't want to go back to the Ben Hunt system because if I do, I'll go back to that gutter. A couple of weeks ago, I returned to my office and there's a note on my desk written by a man in our office who I sponsored some time ago. And this is the note. It's about a fellow that I've tried to do something with for the last 7 years. The note says, "Please call Harry, Jackson State 87400. Apparently, gangrene of the soul has set in." Isn't that awful? And yet, I don't know of a better description of what was wrong with me when I came into AA. I didn't recognize it at the time, but it sure was gangrene of the soul. You know, insidiously, I believe I became an alcoholic. My folks didn't train me to be an alcoholic any more than your folks trained you to be an alcoholic. Insidiously, things came about by which I became an alcoholic. And I believe that insidiously, we can become drinking alcoholics again. Unless we are vigilant and diligent in the application of these principles, we'll lose our desire to stay sober. We'll become complacent, self-sufficient, and we'll return to our old system of thinking and living. How did I become an alcoholic? I didn't know in the beginning, but I was told that I better find out why and how, or I might go back again. And so by going to meetings, I pick up a little here and a little there, and I finally come to the conclusion that I came into AA because I was in trouble. And by the way, is there anybody in the room that came in that was not in trouble? Please raise your hand. We seem to all stand out that way, don't we? We came in because we were in trouble. I was in trouble with Babylon. I couldn't live with myself. This system of thinking and living, this Benhouse system, got me so that I had to be half gassed to go to sleep. Why? Because my conscience bothers me. Dr. Marlon Vincent Peale calls conscience The meaning that fits your soul tells you when they go wrong. You don't have to do the things to get involved. Even when you start to think about it, that single starts bothering you, doesn't it? I think alcoholics are people with an unusually sharp conscience. And we found out that we could get temporary relief from the use of alcoholic beverages. Oh, if a lot of other people ever found that out, there'd be another 5 million alcoholics tomorrow morning. We found it out though, didn't we? Whiskey makes you thirsty. Oh. It was the only way I could go to sleep. I couldn't go to the door without fear. I couldn't go to the mailbox without fear. I didn't have to worry about the phone. That would jerk out. But there was a barrel without fear. What was in the mailbox? Well, it was some finance company. Came in the door and set out the van. I wasn't in much trouble. I had 3 finance companies. The money's on the same furniture and the furniture was sold. You had to be like that. And you get on that road, Dave, and you're so sick and tired of being sick and tired of waking up in the morning and trying to piece together what you didn't say the night before like a jigsaw puzzle. You get a few component parts set down, start to say, shake. You look at it and you say, shake! I must be sleeping, I must be nuts! I'm never going to do it again. And by the time the sun goes down that day, you're in the bag again. You do that just so often, and by golly, you really get sick and tired of being sick and tired, don't you? I did. So, we find that alcohol gave us temporary relief. It got so that we couldn't get that. And we hear about this society made up of a bunch of people that don't drink. And they're happy, and they're confident, and they're the kind of people that we want to be. And we come into AA, and all we got to start with is hope. Hope that we can make the grade. Hope that we can get out of the doghouse at home and on the job. Hope that we can live with ourselves. We have a desire to stay sober, and we do. 3 days go by, a week goes by. With what little we know about ourselves, about the problem of AA, about alcoholism, we stay sober. Because we've got a desire. And a month goes by, and a year goes by. But unless we maintain that desire, again, I repeat, I'll go back to the Venhouse system. I'll get involved. The next step will be frustration. I won't be able to live with myself. And if I'm sober 35 years, something back here will tell me, one drink will give you a temporary relief, Venhouse. Remember? And if I'm in a state of frustration, thinking goes out and drinking comes in. So it's necessary that we be vigilant and diligent in the application of these principles. That means take a good look at that step 11 often. And we develop in the spiritual realm. We develop a spiritual understanding between us and this God as we understand it. I should have never been a drunk. I came from a family where a Christian environment prevailed every day of our lives. Once in 8 years of living, broke through school. If you didn't get it in your eyes and your ears, you got it through the back end. I'm a Trinity's diverse world. Everything. I should have never been a drunk. But I did. The Venhouse system. From what to use the book system. Well, that's all it says. You wind up behind 8 ball. So God gave me another chance to live by giving me an opportunity to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And my main objective, I hope, shall always be the same as it was the first day I came in AA, to stay sober. That's it. Everything in my life is beyond my sobriety. What responsibility can we assume unless we're sober? I don't go around when these people say I no longer have a drinking problem. Mine's a thinking problem. I never had a problem in my life that didn't require thinking. Now I made a problem with the state. Sober. What good am I to anybody, to my God, to myself, to anything, unless I'm sober? I don't want to go back. Counting my sanity, searing the mailbox, the telephone, the... Oh, everything. But I can't. I can go back. I can take AA out of the number one spot in my life. Because my sobriety hinges on my AA. My business, that's the means of making a living. That business up there. But my main business is staying sober. Without sobriety, I have nothing. I don't want to go back to doubting my sanity again. And you know this development in the spiritual realm. When all the chips are down, and you can look up and you can say, God, honestly, I'm doing the best I can with what I've got. The rest is up to you. And you develop a faith based on experience, not on what somebody told you you read out of a book. Based on that experience that there is a God. And you can put your hand on a pillow and get right to sleep. That I never had before I came into AA. So God gave me a chance to live again. And in my humble opinion, I believe that most of us get just one chance. I have observed amongst my acquaintances in Alcoholics Anonymous that most people who have been sober for 10 years or more made it the first trip around. Only about 2 out of 10 ever had trouble and then stayed sober for 10 continuous years. If they had trouble, it was usually in the beginning. I made that statement in a meeting about 3 months ago, and in our common period, one of the boys got up and he said, "Holy smokes, for 5 or 6 years I've got all kinds of trouble. I can't stay sober more than 3 weeks at a time. And now for the last 9 months I'm going like a dandy. I haven't had a drink of anything stronger than tea. And you come along and you got me running scared." I said, "Buddy, that's the only way I know what I'm running scared. Scared that I might lose what I've got. Scared that I might get sufficient to the point where I don't need AA. Scared. I happen to be a salesman. I know that on every sale that I ever lost, it was usually due to the fact that I thought I had it in the bag. I've been selling them for years. I know the buyer of the first time we played peanut together. They got drunk together. All of those things. Why, he can't buy from anybody else. But he did. But the sales that I knew I had to pull out all the stops to get, the ones I knew that my competitor was really embedded, he was out there in front. Those were the ones I worked the hardest, and I was running scared that I might lose them. I've got to operate on every sale like a red money is riding on it. And that's the way I've got to live this life. If I want to stay sober, I've got to continue to play AA in that number one spot because that's where I get my sobriety. When there's ever a loving God, there's only trust and supply that I have in the way of help. It's necessary that I go to these meetings in order to be available. Available so that I can receive his help from him through me. Available so that he might use me to help someone else. But I'm not going to be available to good advantage unless I'm in an AA meeting. Oh, I can meet a few of the boys once in a while in a restaurant where they meet every noon. And I might see them in a hospital or in a nursing home, which is fine. But there's nothing that takes the place of an AA meeting to be available. And then conferences like this. There's a spirit of oneness that prevails in these gatherings that you can't get anyplace else. I have never heard anybody give a proper description, a word picture of an AA conference. Everybody winds up and says, well, you gotta be there. And that's true. You gotta be there. When you leave, I know how you feel about a conference. Every AA feels the same way. This is the top. This is the best. But when you leave here, try to describe what they're not. Try to tell somebody else. Those of you who have tried, you know what I'm talking about. You know what? Tell the people the same thing. You gotta be there. Where can you feel this spirit any place else? I can't get it any place else. I've talked to hundreds of other people the same way. And all this opportunity to be a delegate. You know, God saved me triple time ever since I've been in AA. So many opportunities. You see where I come from? I live only a few miles from King's School. I don't go to King's School. I got my AA in Cleveland, and I'm still loyal to that part. But I live close to Athens. This is no reflection on King's School. I want you to say for 15 years you're an neophyte. The fact. There are a lot of people there that helped write the first book. The oldest living member of AA outside of Bill Wilson lives about a mile and a half from me, Bob Irby. He wrote The Salesman in the original book. A lot of solid AA. But when I came around with this delegate deal, you see, we were so self-sufficient up there that for 2 years we didn't even bother about sending a delegate. Nobody was watching. You see, these old boys, they say, well, we didn't have Ohio come in, don't need it now. We proposed our interview to Alvin Sinclair, and they said the same thing. Don't need it. Didn't have it, we come in. Well, as time went on, we had an awful time supporting it. But now there's been so many people came through that interview's office, just their first contact, you can't talk them off of it. And so we're operating this year with a budget of $16,600, and it was raised in 2 weeks. But our AA activity is confined, and I'm thinking too, with a lot of our people in just northeastern Ohio. They talk about general service, and when I went to the first conference in New York, one of the old boys called me on the side, and he said, now you watch out for them city cuckers. And that Bill Wilson, he'll climb a bird out of a tree. Watch him. You see, our society has grown way beyond the imagination of a lot of people. And our world service is now directly responsible for over 1,500 groups in foreign countries. Sure, we didn't have it in the beginning, of course not. Well, it took us 4 years to get the 12 steps of writing, didn't it? Before the book was published. 4 years, 1939, before they ever had the 12 steps of writing. And then the next period, they ought to hammer out those traditions on the anvils of experience, and we didn't get that settled and accepted until 1950 in Cleveland. And then in 55, after general service, the trial balloon went up in 51, and it was proven by 55 it was necessary. General service does the things for groups that the groups can't do for themselves, and all of the public relations and the publishing and everything else, you think you're in the Carolinas to take care of? You think the Southeastern Conference to take care of? You think we could do it up there? Why, no, it's the combined experiences and thoughts and goals of all of our ways. In 1955, the third legacy, World Services, was accepted and approved. And we still got people saying, oh, no, I don't need it now. Didn't Dr. Smith say, keep it simple? Dr. Smith did say that. I was there. I heard him. He just simply went away from Freudianism. He said, keep the program simple. What is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? As I understand it, it's the found steps, and it's still the same simple program as the day they put it in writing. What changes have taken place? The improvement in the method of carrying the message. And what are the greater purposes that we got as alcoholics in a group? To carry the message. We find conflicts that we've got. The great time. The literature. The book. Yours and mine. And by the way, it wasn't for the profit of the publishing company. The doors in the office have been closed plenty long ago. We claim about 200,000 membership, and this year we're operating with a $186,600 budget. We're going to be around 15 grand short. I guess some of it is the lack of understanding. Or we should pay our share. I'm positive of that. The lack of information, I'm sure, is another reason. But regardless of that, I still think there's some of us got t-shirts in our pockets and boxing gloves in our hands and a chunk of dough for dough. We look here at people that say, give all the dirt in the 5 yards in the back room, too. I know I was. I paid the bar bill before I paid the landlord. I owed $8,000 when I came in AA, and I didn't owe $6 to saloon keepers. We come into this Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a lot more to it than just being sober, isn't there? To enjoy our sobriety, that's absolutely necessary, or we'll go back to drink. To live the kind of a life that he wants to help the redeemed from an ever-loving God. To prove our love for him with action. This AA must be exciting to us. And the only way I know of getting excitement is for action. Action comes first, then comes excitement. I never had excitement without action, and you didn't either. If you'll buy the Third Legacy Manual, if you'll buy AA Comes of Age, and I mean buy it, don't wait till you win it, buy it! And learn that there's a lot more to this AA than just the 12 steps. The 12 steps is where we recover. The 12 traditions is where we found our unity. But in the Third Legacy, that's where we go to work. That's where we prove our love for this ever-loving God. Yes, it's wonderful at the end of the day and say, thanks, God, for another chance to die. We owe that to him. And it's nice to know that we can appeal so many times. And if in his opinion it's good for us, we'll get it. But you don't do it sitting on your fanny. I found that out. I go to these hospitals and nursing homes, and I see people that forgot to remember. And invariably they all say the same thing. I sit during the meeting. And you know, I've asked this question so many times, and I'm convinced that this is so important now, more than ever before. I don't know of a man that ever dreamt the day that he asked for a house. The day that he prayed for a house. He didn't ever dream that day. It's hard for us to imagine a God with such unlimited love and mercy and help. But I believe he's omnipotent, but he's all-powerful. Anything is possible with him. I believe that he's omnipresent. He's with us all the time. He's as close to us as we want him to be. But when I begin to believe that he's omniscient, that he knows what goes on in my mind, that when I had to be on the ball. My motives and my intentions, are they proper and honest? You see, if there wasn't a God, I wouldn't have a conscience. Because I could think and no one would know what was on my mind. They wouldn't know my intentions and my motives, just me. But the fact that I believe there is a God, and I believe he knows what goes on in my mind, I'm caught when I'm thinking wrong. And that's when I've got to pray. God, please help me change my mind. I don't want to go through with this. If I do, I'll become involved. The next step is frustration, and that is when an Alfie is on thin ice. He's frustrated. He can't think. Your grace, I don't want to drink. I can't drink with safety. I've had too many years to prove to me that I can't drink with safety. But I can't afford to look at my quitting drinking as a sacrifice. I can't say, isn't it a shame? Tonight, he's frustrated. He can't drink. Your grace, I don't want to drink. I can't drink with safety. I've had too many years to prove to me that I can't drink with safety. But I can't afford to look at my quitting drinking as a sacrifice. I can't say, isn't it a shame? On a hot day like this, I can't even have a cold bottle of beer. I got an uncle who's 5 years old who drinks beer and plays piano all night long. I can't drink. I can't think like that. But I can't think this way. Even one of them is so mad. I don't have to drink. Thanks for that.